Daniel chapter 5. A pastor was attending a Bible study conference one Sunday and happened to be away from church. Well, the church secretary decided to put an announcement in the bulletin explaining the pastor's absence. She meant to type, "Our pastor is away this week attending a study conference." But when she went to type the word study, she left off the Y. So the announcement read, "Our pastor is away this week attending a stud conference." What made it even more funny were the following words, "Please keep him in your prayers." Tonight, in Daniel chapter 5, we're going to study a stud conference. A wild party, an orgy, a banquet complete with wine and women thrown by the Babylonian king Belshazzar. A party that got way out of hand, and as a result, got interrupted by the hand of God. God decides to crash this blasphemous Babylonian bash. As we'll see, God gets a strange, backhanded kind of invitation to this party, and He makes His presence known in even a stranger way. Let's join the party already in progress in verse 1. "Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of 1,000. Now 23 years have passed between chapters 4 and 5. King Nebuchadnezzar is now dead and gone, and reigning over Babylon is his grandson Belshazzar. Now for the last 20 years, Babylon has been at war with the Medes and Persians. And for the last 2 years, the Medes and Persians have actually had the city of Babylon under siege. But despite the onslaught, the Babylonian king Belshazzar has remained confident. He has felt that the Babylonians were invincible and the city was impregnable. Herodotus, the Greek historian, gives us some impressive details about the city of Babylon. The city was 15 miles square. It was surrounded by a double wall, which was separated by a 30-foot moat. The outer wall was 311 feet high and 87 feet thick. In other words, you could place 11 cars abreast on top of the walls, the outer wall of Babylon. The wall had 250 watchtowers, some of them extending an additional 100 feet above the wall. Even by modern standards, the wall was a high-tech, high-rise architectural masterpiece. The river Euphrates flowed under the city walls, providing Babylon with a continual source of water. And some historians suggest that Babylon had food supplies that would last them for 20 years. No wonder Belshazzar felt so smug and self-assured. To show off his confidence, he holds this party. On a night when his enemies are outside plotting, Belshazzar and his men are inside partying. They think that they're in no danger. Incidentally, the archaeologists have found what they believe to be the actual banquet hall where Belshazzar held his party. In the ruins of Babylon, they have found a room that has been connected or was connected to the king's palace. The room was 56 feet wide by 173 feet long. Across the main entrance, there was a double niche where apparently the king himself sat. And it's interesting that on the long wall above that niche where the throne would have been, there was a long wall that was plastered with white plaster, which would have made for an interesting backdrop for what happens next. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink. He brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them. Now, Belshazzar's banquet quickly turns into a drunken orgy. It's interesting, but most Oriental kings did not drink in public. And their sexual antics were restricted to their harem. But Belshazzar disregards all royal protocol. Belshazzar was a boozer. He was a drunk. He was a party animal. He knew no restraint. He was a playboy. He had never learned when to say when. You know, it was bad enough for him to involve himself in this immoral conduct. Worse was the blasphemies that followed. Belshazzar calls for the temple treasures, the vessels that had been used in the temple in Jerusalem. When Nebuchadnezzar had conquered Jerusalem, he had stolen from the temple the sacred vessels that God had ordained for the temple service. Nebuchadnezzar had brought these sacred vessels back to Babylon and had sort of sported them as spoils of victory, as trophies of his conquest. They had been in the back rooms, they had been in the treasure chest of Babylon, but now suddenly Belshazzar brings them out in a blasphemous action. He takes these sacred saucers, the dedicated dishes, the consecrated cups, the vessels that God's law had restricted for temple service, the vessels that were to be used in the temple were to only be used in the service and sacrifices of God. Belshazzar knew this. But because of his arrogance, because of his defiance, he deliberately defiles these holy vessels. He brings them out deliberately in order to blaspheme God, and he uses the sacred vessels of God as beer mugs. Can you imagine if we were in the midst of taking communion? And suddenly an inebriated, drunken sot comes stumbling down the aisle. And he reaches up and he throws the wine out of the communion cups. And he passes it around to his buddies and they use the communion cups as shot glasses. And they pour themselves a round of whiskey. And they toast the prostitutes that they've brought with them with the communion cups. Now you're beginning to feel what God must have felt, the rage, the anger. This was a blasphemous act on the part of Belshazzar. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. Secular records show that Belshazzar's father, Nabonidus, who was co-regent with Belshazzar, was a very superstitious fellow. And he had stolen the gods of the surrounding cities and had brought them into Babylon sort of to help secure the borders of Babylon, as if bringing in all these gods sort of added to the security of the city. No doubt Belshazzar's banquet hall was adorned with these various gods. And here they are using the sacred vessels of Jehovah God, stolen from his temple, using them to toast the worthless gods of wood and stone. In the same hour, or literally suddenly, better translation would be suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. The handwriting on the wall. We're not talking about a kid with crayons here. That's the kind of handwriting on the wall that most of us are used to. No, we're talking about the finger of God. Now, talking about sobriety. Here we're talking instant sobriety. I am sure this shook Belshazzar. He didn't need a stiff cup of coffee. He saw this handwriting on the wall and he was instantly sober. In a backhanded kind of a way, Belshazzar had invited God to his party. If he had not wanted God there, he should have never been toying with what God considered sacred. He should have never thumbed his nose in God's face. God had no choice. God had to act to vindicate what was holy and what was righteous. And so God crashes the party. Sometimes God is late in responding. But God will always vindicate. God will always show Himself strong. God will always judge those who thumb their nose in His face and blaspheme against Him. You can imagine the tension that filled the room. Suddenly, they saw the finger of God writing on the wall. What if suddenly we looked up and there was a finger writing a wall, a message on this wall over here, addressed to you? Talking about tension. Then the king's countenance changed. I'm sure it did. God has thrown a damper on this party. And his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked against each other. James has cautioned me. I need to be careful here. The joints of his hips were loosened. Man, that's King James language for it scared the stuffing out of him. Belshazzar's problem was not too many party prunes. We're talking a divinely inspired diarrhea comes upon Belshazzar. Man, it scared the guy to death. His knees begin to knock. Reminds me of a story of a British naval captain who one day his cabin boy ran into the cabin and said, "Captain, Captain, there's a Spanish galleon on the port side of the ship. What should we do?" And the captain hollered, "Fetch me my red vest and sound the battle stations." A few days later, the cabin boy again ran into the quarters of the captain and he said, "Captain, Captain, there's two Spanish galleons on our port side. What should we do?" He said, "Fetch me my red vest and man the battle station." Well, a few days later, the cabin boy walked into the captain and he said, "Captain," he said, "this is strange." He said, "Please tell me, why is it that whenever you go into battle, you always wear your red vest?" He said, "Well, sonny," he says, "I might sustain a hit in battle. And I don't want my men to see me bleeding and it would get them discouraged. And so I always wear my red vest into battle." So a few days later, the cabin boy comes running into the quarters and he says, "Captain, Captain, the whole Spanish armada is on our port side." And the captain said, "Son, fetch me my red vest and my brown pants and sound the battle station." Well, that's what's happened here to Belshazzar. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans and the soothsayers. And the king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Now all of the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. You'd think they'd eventually get these guys off the payroll, wouldn't you? Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. Now, we don't know who this queen was. It's possible that this was the queen mother. There are many who think that this was Queen Amytis, who was the widow of Nebuchadnezzar. She is famous because she was the one for whom he built the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon. When she was young, she was brought to Babylon to be married to the king, but she missed the green hills of her hometown. And so in order to end her homesickness, he built these incredible, famous gardens there in the city of Babylon. It may have been the widow of Nebuchadnezzar that came in. She spoke, saying, "O king, live forever." This was the common Oriental protocol, the proper greeting for the king. Remember, this is how Daniel always greeted Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God. And in the days of your father, apparently, you know, she was an older woman, obviously, because she remembered back in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king. I mean, in other words, he's a real king. You know, kind of a little dig here at this young upstart. Made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Don't get confused here. Belshazzar was actually Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, not his son. But in the Chaldean, there was no word for grandson or grandfather. And so whenever they spoke of a male ancestor, they called him father. It could be the grandfather, the great-grandfather. It was just father. There was no different words for, you know, second generation and so forth. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. Now apparently, this brash young Belshazzar had retired Daniel. He didn't think he needed Daniel's godly wisdom. You know, maybe you have friends who have retired you. They have rejected you now that you've become, as they put it, a religious fanatic. They don't have any use for you anymore. You don't like the same things that you used to like. You don't run around and drink with them and all like you used to do. Maybe you have some friends that have retired you. Joseph Parker wrote, "Preachers of the Word, you will be wanted someday by Belshazzar. You have not been invited to the feast, but you will be there before it ends. The king will not ask you to drink wine, but he will ask you to tell the secret of his pain and heal the malady of his heart. Just wait for your time, preachers. You are nobody now. Who cares for men of insight while the wine goes around and the feast is unfolding its tempting luxuries? But the preacher will have his opportunity. They will send for him when all other friends have failed. May he then come fearlessly, independently, asking only to be a channel through which divine communication can be addressed. Then may he speak to the listening trouble of the world." You've been blocked out by your friends because of your faith in Jesus Christ. But you will have an opportunity to speak into their lives. Eventually they'll get into trouble. Eventually they'll need someone of insight. They'll call for you. You'll be invited to the feast. What you'll have to say will be important to them. You'll get that opportunity. You just be patient. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the thing." I'm sure that didn't surprise Daniel. "And I have heard of you that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another." Now, if I was translating that into modern English, I won't. But I could express that in some very colorful ways. He's saying, you stick this, king. "You know, yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom in majesty and glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne. And they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was like the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, and he appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. Nebuchadnezzar had learned some lessons that Belshazzar had forgotten and ignored. You know, you remember when Daniel addressed Nebuchadnezzar, he always did so as the queen mother had addressed Belshazzar, "O king, live forever," observing the proper protocol. But notice that's not how he addresses Belshazzar. He just gets right into it. No, none of this, "O king, live forever" stuff. You know, Daniel had a real respect for Nebuchadnezzar, even when Nebuchadnezzar was a vicious, brutal king. Nebuchadnezzar was still respected by Daniel because God had appointed Nebuchadnezzar as his instrument, as his tool. And so Daniel, realizing Nebuchadnezzar's place in God's plan, respected him and acknowledged his position. But not so with Belshazzar. Here in essence, he's telling Belshazzar, "Now you remember your grandfather? Now he was a real king. That was a real king. He learned his lessons. God humbled him. He went through that terrible ordeal of being brought down, driven into madness, living like a beast, in order to learn that God is the one who rules. God is the one who sets up and puts down. God is the one who ultimately holds our lives in his hands." Nebuchadnezzar was a king. "But you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know, and the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." What a sermon. You know, Daniel's going to get around to the interpretation, but not before he gets an opportunity to speak his piece, to preach a little sermon here. Man, never forget that it's God who holds your breath in his hands, who owns all your ways. Don't you be a fool and think that you're a self-made man. You're not. It's the providence of God that has opened the door for blessing to come into your life. Understand that everything you have is not because you've gained it, not because you deserved it or earned it, but because God in His grace has seen fit to bless you with it. And in an instant it can be taken from you, just as it was taken from Nebuchadnezzar. You need to be careful. You need to humble yourself. You need to give the glory to God, because it is God who deserves it. Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the inscription that was written. This is what appeared on the wall. "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." Now these were Aramaic words. "Mene" means numbered. "Tekel" means weighed. "Upharsin" means divided. And so the message read, "Numbered, numbered, weighed, and divided." Now, the question arises, why were the Babylonians unable to read this message? The Babylonians knew Aramaic. And so why couldn't they have translated these words? We're not sure. There are some who believe that God imposed a supernatural impediment. He brought kind of a blindness upon their thinking. There is a tradition in the Jewish Talmud that the letters were written vertically rather than horizontally, and thus it confused the Babylonians. We're really not sure why the Babylonians couldn't read the inscription, but Daniel could. That was the important thing. He says, and this is the interpretation of each word. "Many, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it." In the modern vernacular, "Your number's up." You've had your day of opportunity, and yet you've been wicked. You've blown it. Now time's up. We've all played these board games. You know, they have that silly little timer. And you know, it's your turn to answer the question or play the game, and they take and they turn that little timer over, and the sand drifts into the bottom of the hourglass. And as soon as it, hey, it's over, man. Time's up. Well, did you know that God has an hourglass on each one of you? And that right now the sand is filtering to the bottom of that hourglass. And one day, that last grain is going to drop to the bottom and your number will be up. Time will be over. Right now you have opportunity to give your life to Jesus Christ. One day that opportunity will be over. He says, Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. In other words, when stacked up against God's standard, this king had no substance. He was a spiritual lightweight. It's interesting that the Hebrew word, which we translate glory, literally means heavy. And though some of us, when we get on the scales, I mean physically, we're pretty heavy, spiritually, we're all found lacking. We're all featherweights. We're all lightweights. We're told in Romans chapter 3 that we've all come short of the glory of God. When we put our righteousness or our heaviness on one side of the scale, we put God's heaviness or righteousness on the other side of the scale, God's heaviness is so much heavier than ours. We can't even the balance. There's only one way to add to our side to even the balance, and that's with the righteousness of Jesus Christ. It's when we accept Him and trust Him that He throws His weight in on our side of the scales and balances out God's scales on our behalf. Then He says, Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Perez is the singular of the plural eupharsin, which appeared on the wall. The word actually had a double meaning. The word literally meant to divide by breaking. And that night, the kingdom of Babylon would be broken, would be conquered and divided. The word was also the Aramaic for Persian. And it was actually the Persian army that was on the outside of the city walls on the verge of an invasion. It was the Persians who were the enemies. And they were only minutes away of assaulting Belshazzar and actually killing the king and taking over, conquering the city of Babylon. The night that all this transpired was October the 12th, 539 B.C. Outside the walls of Babylon, the Persian general, Ugubaru, had divided his army into thirds. Ugubaru, name your kid that. What a great name. But Ugubaru had divided his armies into thirds. He had placed two-thirds of the army at the juncture where the river Euphrates flowed under the walls of Babylon. He had taken one-third of his army and had sent it upstream where the army was to divert the Euphrates River into a lake. And so while the Babylonians were partying in the city, the level of the river Euphrates kept going lower and lower and lower. Until around midnight, the river got low enough where the Persian army could slip under the walls of the city and enter into the city and conquer the Babylonians. You see, in the end, they didn't go over the walls. They went under the walls through the dried up riverbed. A very clever ploy by Ugubaru. Now, when the Persians went under the wall, they found by some happenstance that the gates that were leading from the river into the city had been left open. Whether this was an act of God or whether this was maybe just the drunkenness of the guards or just the lax security, we don't know. But they entered into the city of Babylon and they took it without a battle. Literally, they took the city without firing a shot. This impregnable city, this unconquerable city, was taken without firing a shot. That very night, Belshazzar was slain in his banquet hall where he had boasted against God. God's judgment was fulfilled. The Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon without a battle. Today you can go to the London Museum, and there you can examine a cylinder known as the Steel of Cyrus, in which the Cyrus, the Persian king, boasts of how he humbled Babylon, how he conquered her without a battle. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. What a hollow reward. Daniel realized that in a few minutes the Babylonians wouldn't even be running Babylon. Let's bring home the message of this chapter with a little poem. All the feast of King Belshazzar and 1,000 of his lords, while they drank from golden vessels, as the Book of Truth records, on that night as they reveled in the royal palace hall, they were seized with consternation at the hand upon the wall. So our deeds are recorded. There's a hand that's writing now. Give your heart to Jesus, to His royal mandate bow. The day is approaching, the day of judgment. It's coming upon each one of us, when the sinner's condemnation will be the writing on the wall. In a sense, the writing on the wall has been delivered. The message has been delivered. The warning has been sounded for each one of us. We need to pay heed. And while we have the opportunity, accept Jesus Christ. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that 14 days after the fall of Babylon, the Persian king Cyrus, who was Darius's boss, entered the city and was greeted by an old man with a dusty scroll. Josephus says that this old man was Daniel, and the dusty scroll was the scroll of Isaiah. And it was Daniel who showed King Cyrus how that Isaiah, prophesying some 160 years prior, had described Cyrus, his career, his methods, even his means of victory, how he came to power. All this had been predicted by Isaiah. And if you remember our studies in Isaiah, Isaiah 44 and 45 gave vivid detail as to what would happen that very night during the fall of Babylon. Of course, all this information impressed Cyrus. I mean, to read in a scroll that was written 100 years earlier, your very name. Remember, Isaiah had mentioned him by name 100 years before he was even born. To read this, to see this, impressed King Cyrus. And Cyrus gave to the Jews favored nation status. In matter of fact, he made his decree, one of his first decrees, was the Jews could return to their homeland, even sending out a decree that financed their trip. All this in fulfillment of what Isaiah had prophesied about Cyrus. You remember, he released the temple treasures and allowed Zerubbabel to take the treasures and the Jews who were willing and go back to the land and rebuild their temple. One archaeological note before we go to chapter 6. For many years, the name Belshazzar had been questioned by the liberal critics because it had not appeared in any other ancient source, any of the archaeology, any of the secular histories. And so many people questioned the historical validity of Daniel. That is, until 1861 and 1882, archaeologists released a series of documents. They published what they had found on some cuneiform tablets. The publication became known as the Nabonidus Chronicles. And in it, they had found these documents where Nabonidus had stated that his son Belshazzar, mentioning him by name, was actually his co-regent. And that he had given him authority over Babylon, the Babylonian army, and the region around Babylon, and thus The Nabonidus Chronicle silenced the liberal critics and did much to bolster, in their view, the credibility and the historical accurateness of the book of Daniel. This also explains another thing that puzzled Bible scholars for many years. Why did Belshazzar offer Daniel the third position in the kingdom? Why not the second position in the kingdom? It was because he was co-regent with his father Nabonidus, and thus the highest position he could offer was that of third in the kingdom. Now it pleased Darius. Darius was the Persian king that took over, to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. And over these, three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Now understand that by this point, Daniel is in his late 80s, early 90s. And yet he's still going strong. It reminds me of the woman who celebrated her 100th birthday. And at the birthday party, a reporter asked her, "Do you have any children?" She said, "Not yet." Not yet. Daniel remained active, even in his older age. And as an insider in the Persian government, he represented the Jewish interests. This is why the Persian king Cyrus was so benevolent to the Jews and to the Jewish cause. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. It's been said, jealousy is the tribute mediocrity pays to excellence. And these Persian officials were jealous, green with envy over Daniel. Everything Daniel did, he did with excellence. Daniel was faithful to his king and to his God. And somehow he was able to blend the two. Everywhere he went, he was faithful. I'm sure he was on time at work. I'm sure he did a good job. I'm sure he didn't take 30-minute breaks when he was supposed to take 15-minute breaks. Daniel worked hard. He was a solid witness for his God. Daniel was faithful. Daniel was a benefit to the king. The king knew he could trust Daniel. These other guys were playing their shenanigans, as politicians do, making money off of the kingdom and so forth, pocketing the money themselves. The king knew that he could trust Daniel and was thinking about appointing him to the chief position, to his second in command over the whole kingdom. This angered the Persians. And they met in clandestine quarters, in secret quarters, in darkened rooms. They began to plot the undermining of Daniel, how they could bring him down. Political subterfuge is not a modern invention. It's been going on for a long time. Politicians plotting how that they could get at their political enemies, how they can bring down other politicians. Such was the case with Daniel. They got the Persian FBI on the case. They hired some private investigators to dig into Daniel's past. They tried to orchestrate Daniel's downfall. Surely they would be able to dig up some dirt on this man. But to their dismay, Daniel turns up clean. He was not a womanizer. He had no vested financial interest in the Persian savings and loan. He had never dipped into campaign funds for his own personal use. He had even paid Social Security on his domestic workers. Man, Daniel was clean. He was blameless. Now, what about you? How blameless are you? Now, let's just forget about your past, okay? What if we were to hire a private investigator to follow you around for just the next 30 days? To watch your every move, to examine your checkbook, to run the financial reports on you. What if we were to hire a financial investigator to monitor next 30 days you'll have to file your income tax? To look closely at you, to examine you. Would your enemies have fun with your file at the end of those 30 days? Or would they find you blameless as they found Daniel? You see, it's fascinating to me that Daniel was able to live and work in a pagan political environment for 75 years. And yet, no one could find any dirt on him. He was clean. He had remained faithful to his king and to his God. Alexander McLaren writes of Daniel, "It's remarkable that a character of such beauty and consecration as Daniel's should be rooted and grow out of the court where Daniel lived. For this court was half shambles and half pigsty. It was filled with luxury and sensuality and lust and self-seeking and idolatry and ruthless cruelty. And in the middle of this there grew up that fair flower of character, pure and stainless by the acknowledgement of his own enemies." The point is that you can do it. If Daniel did it, you can do it. It is possible to live in this pagan world and not be polluted by it. You don't have to be contaminated by your environment. You don't have to stoop to the standards around you. You can keep your standards high. You can remain pure. You can safeguard your mind and your heart and not contaminate the stream that flows through it. Yes, you might have to drive through the smog and pollution of this world, but you can keep your windows rolled up. You don't have to let it in the car. You don't have to let it contaminate you. Don't let this world press you into its mold. You stand up and stand out. And through God's blessing and help, you'll still survive. It's not only possible to live in this pagan world and live cleanly and purely, God expects it. So forget about your flimsy excuses. If Daniel could do it, so could you. So can you. We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Here was his one Achilles heel. Man, he was devoted to God. So how can we turn his devotion into his destruction? Now they had found no way to work on Daniel, and so they decide to turn and work on Darius. This is much more successful. And so these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and the satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree. We want you to be king for the month, God for the month. They say that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions." God for a month. Boy, that sounds good. "Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree." Now, they had found no fault in Daniel, and so they turned to Darius. They compel him to sign this stupid decree. Now, I believe that under any other circumstances, Darius would have seen through this and would have never signed such a foolish decree. You know, for 30 days, no one could petition anyone other than the king. No one could petition their God. No one could come to God and pray. Imagine the loved ones who have sick people in the hospital that are on their deathbed. They can't pray to their God for healing. What about the kids who have tests? They're on their own? What about the farmers who need rain? You mean they can't pray to God for God to bring rain? This was a stupid decree. Now, Daniel's enemies used three tools to get Darius to do something that he wouldn't ordinarily do. You know, some of you do some stupid things. Things that under any other circumstances you wouldn't do. But somehow, Satan uses these same three tools on you in order to cloud your judgment, in order to prompt you and persuade you to do that foolish thing. First, they create a disrupting fanfare. Notice it says they thronged before the king. You know, they just created a fanfare. They created confusion. They just threw a lot at him at once. Satan ever done that to you? Be careful. Don't act impetuously or impulsively. Second, they falsified the truth. You know, they said that all the governors had collaborated on this idea. Had all the governors collaborated? What about Daniel? Had Daniel been in on it? Of course not. And I doubt if many were behind it. This was probably orchestrated by just sort of a very few group of men. They falsified the truth. And third, they used flattery on this Oriental monarch. Be careful. Satan will falsify the truth and he will flatter you. He'll bring that non-Christian boy into your life and tell you. And that boy will start telling you how beautiful you are and how much he'd really like to date you. And you'll compromise and you'll go out with that non-Christian fella. Or somebody at work will tell you what a wonderful businessman you are. Man, what a genius you are. If you just got involved with them and what they're doing, boy, you know, this plan would certainly be successful. And how easily we're flattered. How easily we buy the lies of Satan. We need to be on guard. We need to be careful. In the midst of the fanfare and falsehood and flattery, the king makes a rash decision that has terrible consequences. Consequences that Darius lives to regret. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Now, Daniel knows that the decree has been signed. It's no longer just a nasty rumor. He knows that it's on the legal dockets. On the one hand, he could have rationalized. Well, you know, God will hear me if I just pray a silent prayer. I don't have to get on my knees in front of the window. You know, Jesus is going to say, let not man see you praying. Go into your prayer closet. You know, one of these days Jesus is going to say that. I'll just go ahead and obey it now. I'll find a closet and I'll pray there. You know, he could have rationalized. He could have decided to allow the fear of man to dictate his approach to God. But not Daniel. He wasn't about to change his daily devotional habits in order to save his own skin. He wasn't going to be motivated and dictated to by the fear of man. But on the other hand, neither was Daniel going to go to the other extreme. Daniel wasn't trying to make a political statement here. This wasn't the activity of an activist. Daniel is not trying to set a precedent here or present a case, a test case for the Supreme Court. This is not what Daniel's trying to do either. He's just going about his daily routine. He's just performing his daily devotions, just doing what he feels like is going to please God. The same things he's done since his early days, it says, from his youth. I'm 90 years old. I'm not going to change now. One good thing about being 90 years old, you really don't have to worry about peer pressure. Oh, that we could build good habits into our lives. You know, you don't have to go out of your way to get persecuted. You know, if you'll just go about a daily devotion to God, persecution will find you. Don't worry. You know, he didn't go out of his way to invite danger, nor did he go out of his way to avoid danger. He just went about serving God as he had before and as God had laid upon his heart. And I don't think we need to be going out of our way to invite persecution or to avoid persecution. We should just go about serving God as he's laid it on our hearts to serve him. Now, notice Daniel goes into the upper room. He opens his windows. He bows to his knees. He prays towards Jerusalem and he gives thanks to his God. Now, notice several things here about Daniel's prayer life. First, Daniel had a place to pray. He goes into the upper room, the attic, apparently. Apparently it was the one place in the house where he could kind of get away from it all and find a quiet place and place where he could go before God and spend time with God. He had a place to pray. Secondly, he had a time to pray. We're told that he prays three times a day. In Psalm 55, verse 17, David said, "Evening and morning and at noon I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice." David also prayed three times a day. Should you pray three times a day? That's a good idea. But don't limit yourself to three times a day. Paul writes to the Thessalonians and he says, pray without ceasing. Constantly be in an attitude of prayer. Third, Daniel had a favorite posture. He prayed on his knees. Now, do all of us have to pray on our knees? Of course not. You can pray with your eyes open. That was a revolutionary thing for me when I realized that you could pray with your eyes open. You can pray with your hands lifted, your hands by your... You can pray laying out on your hammock in your backyard. Probably not for long. But before you doze off, you can pray laying on your hammock. It doesn't really matter. Posture doesn't really matter. I love this little poem that I found. It reads, "The proper way for a man to pray, says Deacon Lemuel Keyes, and the only proper attitude is down upon his knees. No, I should say the way to pray, says Reverend Dr. Wise, is standing straight with outstretched arms and wrapped in upturned eyes." "Oh, no, no, no," said Elmer Slow. "Such posture is too proud. A man should pray with his eyes fast closed and his head contritely bowed. It seems to me his hands should be austerely clasped in front, both hands pointing toward the ground," said Reverend Dr. Blunt. "Last year I fell in Hitchin's well, head first," said Cyrus Brown, "and both my heels were sticking up and my head was pointing down. And I made a prayer right there and then, the best I ever prayed. The prayingest prayer I ever prayed was standing on my head." So hey, whatever works for you. And if bowing your knee will help you to bow your heart, then go for it. Fourth, notice Daniel prayed toward Jerusalem. Jerusalem had housed the temple of God, and the temple of God had housed the presence of God. And so when the exiles prayed toward Jerusalem, they were in a sense expressing their faith that one day God would bring them back to Jerusalem and help them to rebuild their temple. In 1 Kings chapter 8 and 2 Chronicles chapter 6, we're told that when Solomon dedicated the temple, he prayed that one day when the exiles living in foreign lands would petition from those foreign lands and pray back toward Jerusalem, he anticipated this directional praying. He asked God to hear their prayers and bring them back to the land. This is exactly what Daniel was doing, praying toward Jerusalem, just as Solomon had described. In a sense, in the Old Testament, all prayers went through Jerusalem. Did you know that today, Israel's national telephone company has established a service by which you can now fax your prayers to God via the Wailing Wall? And you can just dial a 1-800 number and send a fax to Jerusalem, and they'll take it and they'll put it into the Wailing Wall. And again, they're praying toward Jerusalem. We as Christians no longer need to worry about praying toward Jerusalem, for God no longer dwells in temples made with stone. And yet it's still important that we direct our prayers. Stray pray is not a good idea. We need to direct our prayers. But to where do we pray? To where do we turn? We turn to Jesus. Where do we direct our prayers? In Jesus' name. We're promised and assured that if we pray any prayer in the name of Jesus, God will hear that prayer and answer that prayer. For us, all prayers travel through Jesus. Fifth, notice Daniel's praying had a purpose. Long before James wrote, "Count it all joy when you fall into various trials," Daniel knew the importance of thanking God in any situation. Even under the threat of death, Daniel gave thanks before his God. He thanked God for whatever situation might arise. Daniel had a place, a period, a posture, a position, and a purpose in his prayer life. It would probably not hurt us to model our prayer life after Daniel's. He goes on, "Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God." Oh, that they would catch us praying. Have you ever been caught praying? Anybody ever walked in on you while you were praying? "And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. 'Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?' The king answered and said, 'The thing is true, according to the laws of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter.'" Under Persian law, the monarch was considered infallible. He could never make a mistake, and so even his own decree he couldn't alter, or else he would be undermining his own infallibility. "And so they answered and said before the king that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself." Now who does he blame? Does he blame these satraps and governors and all? No, blames himself. He knows that he's been hoodwinked. He's been bamboozled. It's nobody's fault but his own. Hey, you need to stop blaming other people. You need to stop blaming your circumstances or your environment or your mom or your poor daddy. You need to stop blaming those people. You need to look at yourself, how you've contributed to the problem. "And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him." I would suppose he spent all night with his lawyers, trying to work out some kind of loophole, some way to save his friend Daniel. But to no avail. "Then these men approached the king and said to the king, 'Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed.'" I know that, guys. "And so the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, 'Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you.' Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed." Now, this is interesting. He puts the official seal on the stone, as if he's not so much worried about the lions as he is the threat of foul play. I would imagine he had confidence. He believed that God could deliver him from the lions. He was worried about Daniel's enemies coming in and rolling away the stone and deciding Daniel's fate themselves. "Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. And no musicians were brought before him. Also, his sleep went from him." Now, it's interesting. There's no record here of Daniel being nervous at all. Daniel was 90 years old by now. He had lived long enough to see God deliver him out of many a terrible situation. Daniel knew that his plight would not be determined by the claws of the lions, but by the hand of God. Daniel would rest in peace, one way or the other. It was the king who stayed up all night, who worried, who fidgeted, who feared. He spent the night fasting and praying. You think the roles would be reversed, that Darius would be the one who rested in peace and Daniel would be the one who worried. The whole story reminds me of a line from Shakespeare which reads, "Cowards die many times before their deaths. The valiant never taste of death but once." Then the king arose very early in the morning, probably at the crack of dawn, and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever." Sounds kind of funny coming from Daniel in this situation. You know? "My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you." The den of lions had become a den of miracles. An angel of the Lord had appeared that night to protect Daniel. The lions had contracted a divine case of lockjaw. But you know, I would imagine it was more than just a case of lockjaw. God had to literally alter the nature of these beasts. Because if it had just been lockjaw, so what if they hadn't have eaten him? They would have torn him to shreds with their claws. But God literally altered the nature of these ferocious beasts so that they became tame and docile in the lion's den. Suddenly, these ferocious beasts were as tame as those that Noah led upon the ark, as those that Isaiah talks about when he says in chapter 65, "The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them." That night in the lion's den, Daniel got a glimpse of the miracle that God is going to one day work upon the whole earth, throughout the whole earth. One morning, after the teacher had taught the Sunday school lesson, Daniel in the lion's den, she asked the class why they thought that Daniel had been so brave. One little girl raised her hand and said, "Teacher, Daniel wasn't afraid of the lions because he knew that one of them was the lion of the tribe of Judah." Perhaps that was the key. Perhaps the angel of the Lord that appeared that night and protected Daniel was none other than a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. The lion of the tribe of Judah had joined the lions in the lion's den. Understand that life is littered with lion's dens. We're told in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, that our adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Satan is a beast, and he would like to take a bite out of you. And from time to time, God assigns us a night in the lion's den. We get close enough to hear his savage roar, to see Satan's fangs, to feel the heat of his violent breath. Trouble stalks us. You know, why would God allow us to be thrown in the lion's den? Why did God allow Daniel to be thrown in the lion's den? There's a good reason. There is no better place for us to learn to trust God than in the lion's den. It's one thing to talk about faith. It's one thing to be thrown in the midst of ferocious beasts and be forced to have faith. The lion's den is a scary place. It's where we meet the devil, the roaring lion. But it's also in the lion's den that we meet a loving lion. Jesus is the lion of the tribe of Judah, and He too is found in the lion's den. And sometimes, in order to find Jesus, to realize firsthand the truth of the promise that He'll never leave us or forsake us, to experience His protection and His deliverance, we have to hear the savage roar. We have to feel the heat of His violent breath. We have to go face to face with the enemy in the lion's den. There we find the roaring lion, but there we also find the loving lion, Jesus Christ. And if you want to have faith, if you want to learn faith, you'll thank God for the lion's den. Then the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. And so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he believed in his God. Wow. Understand that whatever is done for God, whatever is done by God, is always done through the vehicle of faith. It's interesting when we get into Hebrews chapter 11, we come to the hall of faith, and there we find, by faith, they stop the mouths of the lions. If God is not working in your life, it is because of one thing. You lack faith. You're not trusting God. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces because before they ever came to the bottom of the den. And so in case you think this was some kind of hypnosis, or Daniel was just real agile and all night he had just been dodging lions, or he had a tranquilizer gun under his robe, or unless you're trying to find some naturalistic explanation for all this, hey, nothing had changed about these lions. It was a miracle from God. When God removed His hand, that ferocious nature aroused, that hunger aroused within them. They'd been patient waiting on dinner. And they had tore these guys to ribbons before they ever touched the ground. Notice the Oriental kings, when they punished an individual, they punished all of his family with him. You know, this was forbidden in the law of Moses. Each person was judged for his own sin. It was unlawful to punish a child for the sin of the father. But the Oriental kings, you know, in order to protect themselves from revenge, from someone having a motive for retaliation, they would just kill the whole family right there on the spot. Then King Darius wrote to all peoples, nations, and languages. You know, it is one other interesting thing. Charles Spurgeon used to say, it's a good thing these lions didn't eat old Daniel. They would have choked on him. Daniel was half grit and half backbone. You know, Daniel would have been a tough meal to swallow for sure. But because the lions cooperated with the will of God, they got rewarded. Instead of a tough old Jew to gnaw on, they were served tender, spineless fillet of coward. Daniel's enemies were a lot better eating than Daniel would have been. We need to understand that the Christian life involves a no-compromise commitment. It really does. And if you seek to live your life for Christ, it will require an unbending dedication, and it will be an offending thing for others. If you decide to live for Christ, you will eventually get marked for the lion's den. When your day comes, will you fidget? Or will you be fearless? Will you be a Darius? Or will you be a Daniel? Will you be spineless, or will you have backbone? Will you be a fillet, or will you be a T-bone? And so Darius wrote to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions? So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. What a powerful testimony coming from a Persian ruler. Obviously, Daniel's life had been a witness. God's deliverance had been a witness. And it profoundly influenced Darius's faith. Who knows? Maybe we'll meet Darius when we get to heaven. And there we have it, Daniel chapter 5 and 6. We finished just under 3 hours. Let's pray. Father, thank you for these two powerful chapters. Thank you, Lord, for speaking to our hearts. Lord, so many things you've showed us tonight, so many things you've challenged us with. Lord, help us to dare to be a Daniel. Help us not cower away from the world's threats, but Lord, help us to stand up, to stick out, to dare to be a Daniel. Lord, to just go about our lives with a daily devotion, totally committed to you, Lord. Not changing for anyone, but just being faithful to you, Lord. Teach us to pray. We can't get away from the fact that prayer was obviously a key to Daniel's faith. Teach us to pray. Lord, may our kids, our spouse, catch us praying from time to time. Lord, we love you. We ask that you work in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray.